Marty Walsh will be an exceptional labor secretary for the same reason that he was an outstanding mayor. He actually carried the tools. He's a worker who came through the ranks and understand workers. I think he's going to do a great job.
I think it's a terrific pick. Everything I've heard from my brothers and sisters up in Massachusetts, Marty Walsh, who's a state rep, and when he was there, he voted with labor as my mayor. He's been great with labor. Of course, he comes out of labor. He's one of us.
We need partners in government. We haven't had that. Let's put the people in place to actually enforce the laws that are out there to protect workers first and foremost.
The lumpen proletariat also includes the lumpen rich.
The Winnipeg General Strike wasn't just a labor story. That whole period was just a boiling cauldron of labor issues, race issues, economic calamity. So it's dramatic as hell.
I think that by coming together and basically leveraging our network together, all the labor producers together who are producing labor media, we can develop and build towards a national channel where working people can get live news.
The year was 1968. That was the day Johnny Cash performed at Folsom Prison.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, we've got reactions to Joe Biden's nomination of longtime union leader Marty Walsh to be Secretary of Labor. From Radio Labor, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka weighs in, as does Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale on America's Workforce Radio. And Labor's political director Josh Slaughter gave his take on UCOM Live. Then we've got some highlights from this week's Labor Radio Podcast Network live stream show, including American Prospect editor Harold Meyerson and Working Class Perspectives associate editor John Russo on the Trump impeachment. Nonprofit Employees Union President Kayla Blato reports on a huge organizing victory, and Nicholas Jurevich, assistant professor of history and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston's College, provides a local perspective on the Marty Walsh nomination. And if you like labor movies, you'll not only want to check out Union Strong's interview with the composer and producer behind Stan, the new labor musical that's been described as Norma Rae meets Hamilton, but you'll also want to check out our screening by the DC Labor Film Fest that's coming up for free this coming Tuesday night at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We've got a link to RSVP in the podcast notes. The focus of this week's Labor Radio Podcast Network member spotlight is Steve Zeltzer, host of Workweek Radio on KPFA. And on Labor History in 2, Johnny Cash, the man in black, plays Folsom Prison. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices. Here's the show.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is a Radio Labor report recorded on Monday, January 11th, 2021. I'm Mark Belanger. In the United States, the incoming Biden administration is moving ahead with cabinet appointments, preparing for progressive labor legislation, actions to create a job-rich recovery, and tackling the pandemic. And incredibly, deal with an attempted fascist coup led by Donald Trump. All this while the Trump administration has been actively opposing Mr. Biden's team during the transition. The AFL-CIO, the largest labor federation in the United States, actively campaigned for Biden's Democratic Party. In an interview, the president of the federation, Richard Trumka, discussed recent events in the country. He mentions as one of the AFL-CIO's priorities the Protecting the Right to Organize legislation, known as the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to form and join unions.
I think the President Biden has done an incredible job of putting together a very skilled and diverse cabinet. Not just diverse in the sense of ethnic background or race or gender, but also in the sense of economic gender, economic diversity. Marty Walsh is he'll be an exceptional labor secretary for the same reason that he was an outstanding mayor. He actually carried the tools. He's a worker who came through the ranks and understand workers. I think he's going to do a great job. For us, the PRO Act is very, very important, because right now you have a tremendous imbalance between employers and workers when it comes to power. And we're never going to get wages and inequality under control unless we give workers more power. And the PRO Act, which is the Right to Organize Act, the passage of that is very, very important. You can't get the economy back on track unless we first take care of COVID. And then when we do that, then we have to have a proper stimulus package that'll start the economy, prime the pump, if you will, get the economy rolling. 26.1 million people are unemployed.
And that's it, International Labor News You Can Use. You can find our features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Here's your host, Ed Flash Farron.
Let's go to line number one and rejoin Rich Bloomingdale. Rich is the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. You probably heard the news last week that Marty Walsh, current mayor of Boston, formerly the head of the building trades over there in New England, was pegged as labor secretary. And I know Rich Trumka was behind him. He had a lot of organizations behind him. Just any thoughts moving forward?
I think it's a terrific pick. Everything I've heard from my brothers and sisters up in Massachusetts, Marty Walsh has been, when he was a state rep, I believe, also. And when he was there, he voted with labor as my mayor. He's been great with labor. Of course, he comes out of labor. He's one of us. So we're thrilled that Marty Walsh is going to be Secretary of Labor. And as you mentioned, he had somebody for 4 years who was trying to constantly undermine the rights of working men and women, and just one regulation after another to roll back safety standards and all the kinds of things that make workers safe, make workplaces healthy. Scalia was rolling back, and it couldn't be a more different 180 opposite ends of the spectrum. As you go from Marty Walsh and from Scalia to Marty Walsh, who's going to do an incredible job as Secretary of Labor. We couldn't be more thrilled and glad Joe picked him. Sends a signal. Too often we have the Republicans are never shy about putting their allies into positions. Sometimes in the past, we've had Democrats, I got to show that I'm not too pro-labor, right? We've had that attitude. Joe Biden knows Marty Walsh. He trusts Marty Walsh. He knows he's going to fight for workers. And Joe Biden, he believes in what we believe in. So he's going to put allies in those departments and make sure that people understand that the Labor Department is about workers. We have the Commerce Department that's about business. And the Labor Department is about workers. And Marty Walsh mm-hmm. is going to take up that mission. And I think he's going to make it stronger than ever in terms of worker training, workers' rights, the rights to join unions. I think Marty's going to be a great Secretary of Labor.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
Here is UCOM Live host Chris LaGrange talking with Laborers Political Director Josh Slaughter.
What do you know about Walsh there, Hanson?
No, he's a phenomenal choice. And diversity aside, I don't think that should be the focus for this particular position. This is somebody that comes from construction unions. He's been a laborer's whole life. He still is a dues-paying member, card-carrying member. And he's got the private sector experience and the public sector experience, having been mayor of a major city. He was also the head of the building trades in Boston prior to that. He's got tremendous experience. His background is perfect for the position. And I couldn't think of a better choice to represent workers throughout the nation. And I think we're going to benefit greatly from it. Diversity aside, it's about picking the person that's going to be best for workers. And I think Biden did that. And it was a great step forward to show all union workers across the country that he's going to be a union president. And I think it was great. We're excited about it. And let's get him to work. One week left till these folks can get in there and start doing the people's business again.
If I could give him some free advice, or if Secretary Walsh, I'm going to call him that from now on, if Secretary Walsh is like, Chris, I want to have a sit down. What do you think I could do to really help the cause, other than refunding everything that was defunded under Trump and encouraging his workforce to continue to kick butt for the working class? What I think you should do is call all major union leaders in every corner of this country, especially in the construction trades, and call like a Gary LaBarbera in New York and whoever runs it in Chicago, LA, Atlanta, Miami, and be like, who are the biggest pains in your butts to progress? Who are the ones skirting around prevailing wages and paying construction wages? Who are the ones who have these weak apprenticeship programs? And instead of doing his tour, showing up where his audience is, which is, Josh, your union hall, maybe he should start going to non-union outfits, saying these are the benefits of having apprenticeship programs and training your workforce in safety. And here are the benefits of being part of organized labor, and continue to fight that. You're going to constantly be begging for nickels. And I work with labor. I come from labor. What do you think, Josh? Is that too ambitious? Is that too concentrated on just one tact? Or is that brilliant?
I think for me, I don't think we need new laws. I just think we need the right people in there that are going to first enforce the existing laws. Prevailing wage violations that you just mentioned, where's the staff to go out there and actually crack down on these contractors that are cheating workers? We're not seeing enough of that. How about OSHA, the health and safety violations, trying to get an OSHA, representative to show up to a job site where there's major violations going on has been almost impossible for the last 4 years. So let's get the staffing in place to actually enforce the laws we have on the books. And I think just workers seeing that kind of representation and knowing that the government's got their back when they're being wronged, it's going to go a long way. And then those non-union workers that are on those sites are going to see that and see the benefit of what the unions are bringing to the table. We need partners in government. We haven't had that. And I think that's going to be the biggest thing that he can bring to the table is let's put the people in place to actually enforce the laws that are out there to protect workers first and foremost, and then we could talk about what we can add to that to better people's lives. Right now, they don't have the staff to do their jobs, and they need to focus on, putting the resources that are gonna back workers and improve their lives, their quality of life, save lives. And I think you'll see more people coming into the unions when you start cracking down on those type of things.
Yeah.
But going to the non-union worker, yeah, of course, it's ambitious, but I think we need to do that here on a local level as well as on the national level. We need to organize folks. We need to be talking to workers that are being exploited as to the benefits that they can get for joining a union. Instead of making them the scapegoat, let's bring them into our ranks. Let's grow the unions. Let's take away the ability for contractors to exploit them by taking the workers away from them. The workers aren't the bad guys. It's the contractors that are taking advantage of them,
yeah,
and are profiting off of that, yeah, absolutely. I think him coming in and showing non-union workers what they can gain by joining a union certainly should be a big focus and will go a long way.
None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us is chained. None of us are free.
All right. Good evening. Hi, and welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Network's weekly live stream. I'm Chris Garlock from Union City Radio. My co-host this week is Patrick Dixon from the Labor History Today podcast. Hey, Patrick.
to be here, Chris. I'm excited about our guest this evening. It's just a shame it's such a quiet week. What are we going to talk about, Chris?
We'll figure that out. A little bit later, so we have a brand new organizing win, so that'll be fun for you. We also get reactions to the nomination of union leader Marty Walsh to be Secretary of Labor, plus why does Maryland need a new state song, and Johnny Cash plays Folsom Prison. But first, there is a little something that happened today. The second, count them, two impeachments of Donald J. Trump. He's number one. Joining us to get a worker's eye view is American Prospect Editor-at-Large Harold Meyerson and John Russo, Associate Editor at the Working Class Perspectives blog. Harold, here's your lead from last week's column. Donald Trump's presidency climax today with the definitive expression of what it's always been about, one man's psychopathic narcissism and his appeal to a pathetic lumpen proletariat.
The lumpen proletariat also includes the lumpen rich. The nuttiness and pernicious racism that was underlying the attack on the Capitol last week really was pretty cross-class. And that includes the definitely non-working class Republican members of Congress who have been abetting this just almost as much as Trump. And they're abetted by their echo chamber in the right-wing media. So there's a lot of blame and guilt to go around, and it's both cross-class and not simply Donald Trump's doing.
John, let me bring you in. Your recent column, also a good opening line. Predictably, politicos and commentators spent much of 2020 debating why working class voters supported Trump and how the Democrats could win them back. Although we've occasionally contributed to these conversations, we're also getting tired of them. So why are you getting tired of these conversations?
I think they've become too simplistic, and I must say, based on sociology and different variables and discussions that really ignore a whole set of cultural issues. And what winds up happening is that the working class gets lumped up as one block when it's much broader, much more difficult to really think about what is the working class. It's interracial. It's not just the white working class. But they'll often get blamed for anything that's happening. And that's why I'm so glad to what Harold said, was that those people who were involved in the riot or coup, however you want to talk about it, it was multi-class.
I appreciate you both taking some time for what I know are very busy days. It makes me feel better being able to talk to you guys. I feel a little bit better than I felt earlier today. So thank you both for that.
All therapy will charge you by the hour.
Our bromides are cheap.
That too, yes. Bromos and bromides, yes.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Hang in there.
You too.
All right. Next up, a very exciting organizing victory. We don't have enough organizing victories, so they're all exciting, but this one is particularly exciting. And to tell us about it, we're going to a longtime friend of mine, Kayla Blado. She's here in Washington, D.C., works with the Economic Policy Institute. For the purposes of this segment, she's president of the NPEU, the Nonprofit Employees Union, one of the fastest growing unions, and has just had an amazing string of organizing victories over the last year when organizing, which has never been easy, Kayla, has been even more difficult. So tell us what's going on.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. So today, NPEU announced our largest organizing victory ever, which is excellent. We went public with the ACLU Staff United. So the staff union of the American Civil Liberties Union National Office has been organizing with us for the last almost a year, probably since the beginning of the pandemic. And they've been organizing for about 2 years internally. And so it's been a lot of work, but today we went public with the campaign and asked management for recognition of their union.
That's exciting news. How big is the unit?
It's about 300 people.
Wow. And I'm assuming, is this at the headquarters? Is this across the country? How does that work?
It's all across the country. They have folks in New York and DC and then states all across the country. We're hoping that the ACLU does the right thing and recognizes their union. We all know that workers' rights are civil rights, and the ACLU should know that as well. So obviously, as our country is in turmoil right now, the ACLU has really important work to be doing. We're not trying to interrupt any of that by forming a union, but it also is extremely important that their workers have the protections of a union.
Congratulations to you and to all the folks, the workers at the ACLU. So keep up the great work. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
I'm excited that we're joined this evening by Nick Jurevich. Nick is an assistant professor of history and labor studies at UMass Boston and also the associate director of the Labor Resource Center. Welcome to the show, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
One of the reasons we wanted to invite you on this evening then was after much deliberation and the floating of various different names, Joe Biden selected his old friend Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, to head up the Labor Department. For many people outside of Massachusetts, he's not a popular figure. Can you tell us a bit about him?
I think in Boston, in Massachusetts, there's first of all relief because the Department of Labor will not be actively hostile to working people and their unions. And that's a very low bar, but I think that is where we're at whenever we have this transition these past two administrations. And yeah, Marty Walsh, so he's the son of Irish immigrants. He grew up in Dorchester. I'm sitting here in Dorchester, about 2 miles from where he grew up. And his father was a member of Laborers Local 223. He joined that union, rose to be, I believe it's secretary treasurer, and then was head of the Boston Building Trades Council, while he was also a state rep. And then in 2013 was elected mayor of Boston. So he's held that post now for two terms. So he's someone who's very much of the building trades, of the labor movement. Certainly there's a lot of enthusiasm for him in that world. People feel he's really done right by his union and people. Here's a guy who has stood in an unemployment line. He's worked on a construction site. He's also acutely aware of the sort of health and safety issues that not just construction workers face, but all workers face. And, you know, having particularly this sort of issue of unemployment and the issue of health and safety at the front of our Secretary of Labor's mind in this moment seems really valuable, I think. I will say one other bit of history. I had to look this up. So there's one other building trades guy who was labor secretary.
Briefly. Okay.
This would be Martin Durkin, Martin P. Durkin of Chicago, a plumber and pipe fitter. And he was Ike's first labor secretary, Eisenhower's, in a cabinet that was dubbed Nine Millionaires and the Plumber. And he stepped down after 8 months because Ike did not repeal Taft-Hartley's right to work and loyalty oath provisions. He'd been told he would. He pushed for it. When the Commerce Secretary undermined him after Senator Taft died, he stepped down. So that too, insofar as Marty has a bully pulpit, Joe's his friend, he's a younger avatar of Joe, that's great. But I would love to see him put that kind of pressure on the administration. Prioritize this, get it through Congress, or else I can't keep working with you. You've got to deliver. I don't know if he'll do that, but I like that there's a model some 70 odd years back now that we can look to of someone saying, you got to do this or I'm walking. And I actually walked.
It's been terrific talking to you, Nick. Thank you so much for joining us.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. Solidarity.
You better listen, my brother, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling from across the years. And they're crying across the ocean. They're crying across the land. And they're willing to we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. If one of us is chained, none of us are free. 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 If one of us is chained.
The New York State AFL-CIO. I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. It's been described as Norma Rae meets Hamilton, a union movie about a union story with a love story woven throughout. It's called Stand and is the number one Canadian movie musical that's now available in U.S. theaters virtually. On the phone with me to talk about the film is co-producer Danny Scher. Danny, welcome to the Union Strong podcast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So I introduced you as co-producer, but I know you also, you wrote the film, music, lyrics, and score, which is impressive.
Thanks. Yeah, I juggle a few hats. My favorite hat is composer, but just shows what you got to do to get a movie made. So I became producer too.
Well, I watched the movie last night and I loved it. The music
you've got songs in there that really stick in your head. So I think that says a lot about the quality of the music and what you put into it. So this is a film based on a true story from 1919 that really covers the core of what drives workers to stand up and fight for better wages and better working conditions, a better life. But this movie is about more than that. Can you give our listeners an idea of the story behind this that you're telling with Stand?
Sure. So as you say, it's set in 1919, and it's set in my city. I'm in Winnipeg, Canada, which, for those who don't know, is 4 hours directly north of Fargo, but just across the American-Canadian border. So in 1919, just like Seattle in February of that year, in May of that year, we had a general strike that lasted 6 weeks and that really changed the history of the country. I won't go into too much detail, but suffice to say, we have a third party, unlike the United States with a party on the right and a party on the left. We have a party further to the left than the centrist liberal party called the National Democratic Party. It sprung from the events of 1919. So just really wide-ranging historic outcomes from that strike, especially to labor. This is a story of biblical proportions to labor. And what I point out to people is that it's like the Alamo to the United States. The Winnipeg General Strike wasn't just a labor story. That whole period was just a boiling cauldron of labor issues, race issues, economic calamity. So it's dramatic as hell.
It is. And you mentioned Seattle from 1919 with the general strike. Mm-hmm. And so it's set up that same idea. You're right after the war. You've got soldiers are back. They're trying to go to their old jobs, which is how your movie starts out.
Those are our jobs.
We don't have a choice. We have to work where the government tells us or they deport us.
So, Golovsky, you working or what?
And right away, there's an issue because these companies are willing, more than willing, to take in the immigrants rather than the soldiers returning because they're going to work for far less money, which is what how things start out.
Yep. And I point out that 1919 was the summer of general strikes mm-hmm. all across the world because of the economic calamity of the post-war era, and inflation was crazy. And so everybody was starving. And then you add to that this return of the veterans from the First World War. And this is the summer that became the Red Summer. I thought that was a reference to a transplanting of the Bolshevik Russian Revolution and a reference to red communists. Well, it wasn't, I found out. It was because all of the blood that was being shed that summer. In the United States, there were 26 white riots. The soldiers that returned in those particular cities, largely the north, but then increasingly through the south, they returned to have those from the black community, mostly in the southern states that had migrated with the Great Migration to the north, seeking jobs and who had received jobs during the Second World War, now confronted with returned soldiers who wanted their jobs back. What we portray in the particular scene in Stand is a bunch of non-black immigrants who encounter the same situation. So it was brutal.
And I thought it was interesting early on when they're starting to talk about it's time to stand up and to fight for better wages. You have, I think it's not Rebecca. It's who's the woman who's playing?
Helen Armstrong is, I believe, who you're referring to, the female labor activist.
And so is that true to the story? It was a woman who got everybody together for that first meeting? Because I thought that was interesting that it was a woman.
Yeah, great until now. Unreported story was the degree of female activists who mobilized whole neighborhoods. They went neighborhood by neighborhood, just as depicted in the movie. And Helen Armstrong, the hair in my arms is going up right now. She's just the most inspiring person from Canadian labor history. Look her up. It turns out she's buried in Los Angeles because towards the end of her life, she moved with her daughter to live there, passed away there, is buried there. But look her up. They called her the Wild Woman of the West. She was like decades ahead of her time. When some in the female activist community were advocating for female suffrage, for women to be able to vote, they were simultaneously still advocating for the sterilization of some undesirable classes of society, read immigrant women. In that climate, Helen Armstrong was saying, this is so wrong. So she was very much on the right side of history, literally 50 to 60 years ahead of her time. And what's depicted in the movies just about exactly what she was doing, and I used many of her words from her many recorded speeches.
Sir, what I have to say affects all of you. Like all workers in this city, you're paid next to nothing. Prices have doubled, but your wages have not. Oh,
that was powerful. And then
your
you had Emma. She's the refugee from racist violence in Oklahoma. And this was something that you added on later to this film. Tell me about that and how that came about.
So we hired a Canadian director with much experience with musical movies, but usually musical dance movies. He was born in Sudbury, which you may know is a major steel town and a major United Steelworkers town. Robert's dad came from Nigeria, married a white German woman, and worked at USW in Sudbury. So Robert had that whole union background. He grew up as a person of mixed race in Canada. He's just like the perfect director ever. His first read of the film, he said to me, Dan, this story is incredible, but it's really white. We just got to get some representation because you've just missed a whole chunk of the story, which is there were black people in Winnipeg. And there were indigenous people. So he said immediately, let's see which characters we can make more representative. That very day was February 1st, 2017, which is the start of Black History Month. I went to Black History Canada Month. Boom, there's a story that I read and I'm shaking my head. I like to consider myself a decent amateur historian. And I had completely missed how the Great Migration didn't end at that U.S. border that's just an hour south of us. Many people from Oklahoma, for example, went to Winnipeg and then west to Regina and Edmonton and Calgary. There was a First World War all-black regiment in Edmonton, in Alberta. So then I checked the census, and one-third of the quote-unquote help in the wealthy part of town was black. This is the women who were domestics while their husbands worked as rail porters. That's the only job that black men could have at that time that was unionized, that paid better. So the character of Emma Jones, the emigre from Oklahoma, was born.
My family came from Oklahoma 10 years ago, running from lynchings. My husband died fighting for this country. But now, they up and change the law. You got this color skin, and they don't let you in no more.
She's played by Lisa Bell, who's a Winnipegger. And as I'm sure you'll agree, and viewers that watch the movie will as well, she's just jaw-droppingly good. And she sings the title song.
Another scene that stands out to me is when they're all in jail together, and there's another great song, and the black men are talking about your concern. He's referring to the white people from Ukraine and others that they're worried about deportation and what some of what they face. Tell me about that scene. That's a great one, too.
So that's our sort of nod to Black Lives Matter. That song has been in the musical since 2005 when I wrote it. And I should point out that the stage musical on which the movie is based is called Strike. When I wrote the song Stand, Robert, the director, was like, we gotta call the movie Stand, and that just stuck. But that song, and it's called Better the Days, it's been in the show right from the beginning since 2005 when it was a stage musical called Strike. But we changed the lyrics and had this great theme set up inside a jail where once there were Black people present singing those words, it just became completely apparent. White people are not aware that in worrying about being deported, the Black people are like, are you kidding me? Come to our side of the track sometime and see how we're being mistreated by the police.
If you sneeze, zip for him. Dirty knees, zip for him. Didn't say please, zip for him. Stung by bees, zip for him. Laid with bees, zip for him. Watered some trees, deportable disease. Deport him, someone please.
Dead of the day, so hope.
So that song and scene becomes a little metaphor, well, quite a big one, for Black Lives Matter.
And I wondered about that throughout. Do you think that this is relatable today?
Oh, my God. I wish I could say I'm such a great writer that I put all this stuff in on purpose. But it's an accident of history that the circumstances of 1919 are so close to today. And, you know, what happened on January 6th in D.C., I mean, we're showing a guy from 1919 who has his own little Twitter account. He controls a newspaper and he bashes out these really provocative and absolutely factually incorrect headlines that his followers take for gospel truth. He has a private extrajudiciary army, in effect, the white armband wearing specials. This is an actual thing from history, from the strike. They did the bidding of this particular character from history and in the movie and acted as a sort of private vengeance army. The parallels just grow closer daily.
Thanks for listening to the Union Strong podcast. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe and give us a rating. This has been a production of the New York State AFL-CIO. Our president is Mario Salento. Our secretary treasurer is Terry Melvin. We're a federation of 3,000 unions representing 2.5 million union members, retirees, and their families with one goal: to raise the standard of living and quality of life of all working people. We keep New York State Union strong by fighting for better wages, better benefits, and better working conditions. For more information on the labor movement in New York, visit nysaflcio.org. Until next time, stay union and stay strong.
This is KPOO San Francisco at 89.5 FM and KPOO.com on the internet.
A hitchhiker from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek.
My name is Evan Papp, and I produce Empathy Media Lab's podcast on labor, political economy, arts, and culture, and we're a proud member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Today, I'm speaking with Steve Zeltzer of Workweek Radio. Steve, could you tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and what led you to organize labor?
I grew up in the Bay Area in San Jose and San Francisco. I was born in San Francisco, and part of the history of the Bay Area and San Francisco is the general strike in 1934. And I was on strike as a student, actually, at San Francisco State with Danny Glover in 1968. And during the strike, I ended up working on the docks. The ILWU supported the strike and allowed us to work on the docks to supplement our income. So I began to become aware of how unions are organized and the need for unions. And in 1994, I began a TV show on community access called Labor on the Job, which ran for about 10 years. And I went into doing regular radio programming on KPFA Pacifica and now on KPOO.com in San Francisco. And also I've been involved in networks. So there was a Union Producers and Programmers Network of labor video producers and programmers in the United States. And I'm also working on the development of an international labor channel, with Pacifica, we have for May Day, we had an International Day of Programming on Pacifica with video and audio from around the world on May Day. So what we want to do is encourage more labor programming, both audio and video, and develop an international multimedia labor channel with music, art, labor stories, and using the internet and social media to get stories out live. There was a mass strike wave in Matamoros in Mexico where auto workers, part suppliers were getting their stories out using Facebook, broadcasting through to the people of Mexico and around the world. And we in labor need to use these tools to get our stories out, to break the information blockade, and to educate and build solidarity of working people both in the United States and globally.
For those who may not be interested or aware of labor news, why do you think that these unions and organized labor are important and should be covered?
Workers are the people who make things go in the world. And without workers, the world wouldn't function. But workers are under tremendous repression. They don't have democratic rights on the job. And workers face intimidation just to fight for health and safety on the job. Requires unions, requires organizing yourself. So at this point, the capitalists in the United States control the means of production. They control the factories. They control the media. And they blame workers for the problems in this country. And workers and the union movement faces an attack on all fronts. The right to organize was fought for historically by workers organizing. So the survival of democracy, the survival of rights has to be an issue for working people. And only if working people are organized collectively can they exercise their rights.
I guess talking a little bit about the Labor Radio Podcast Network, as a member of the network, could you talk a bit about how you learned about it and when you joined and why you think such a network is important?
I've been, as I said, involved in other networks of labor media people, Union Producers and Programmers Network. And also I've been involved in working with labor producers around the world. So I'm as far as networks, the more labor networks, the better. And I think that by coming together and basically leveraging our network together, bringing the shows together, we come closer to developing a national channel. We need a national labor radio channel. We need a national labor video channel. And by bringing all the labor producers together who are producing labor media in Pacifica and at many stations around the country, we can develop and build towards a national channel where working people can get live news, they can get their voices out, and we can see what's going on. As long as the media is controlled by the corporations, there's not a place for labor on a regular basis nationally.
Steve Zeltzer, thank you so much for your time and all the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Is there anything you want to say in closing?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, we need to use these tools and we have to educate ourselves about social media, broadcast tools, and we have to build a workers' media movement and we have to get our stories out. And in doing so, we will encourage and strengthen all working people here and around the world.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day Johnny Cash performed at Folsom Prison. The Man in Black had played numerous free prison concerts before. Country music legend Merle Haggard remembered seeing him perform at San Quentin a decade earlier. Columbia Records recorded the two concerts at Folsom for release. It was these recordings that many credit with revitalizing the career of Johnny Cash. His daughter Roseanne believes the 1968 appearance signified her father's own personal liberation, saying, quote, "That was the moment he came into the light, when he embodied who he really was." Performing with the Tennessee Three, June Carter, Carl Perkins, and the Statler Brothers, Cash hit the charts with Folsom Prison Blues, which sold more than 3 million copies at the time. He also took the opportunity to advocate for prison reform and prisoners' rights, providing testimony on the subject in the early 1970s. His brother told the BBC in an interview, quote, "He identified with the prisoners because many of them had served their sentences and had been rehabilitated in some cases, but were still kept there for the rest of their lives. He felt a great empathy for those people. Cash might not have actually shot a man in Reno, but he always sided with the underdog. His songs highlighted the working man's life, from the sharecroppers, coal miners, and auto workers to railroaders, truckers, and prison chain gangs. Cash always gave an unromanticized view of hard living and hard labor, as well as interracial and class solidarity.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
That train keeps a-rolling.
Of all the people who tell me I should just go sit down, I'm sick of being seen as feeble and being scared in my hometown when you don't count me among.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today, and you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our music this week included the title track of the musical Stan, sung by Lisa Bell. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Evan Papp, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website, laborradionetwork.org. Also, be sure to check out our weekly live stream show, available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network YouTube, where you'll also find those profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next time.
Show.